Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is the return of The Unexplained. Thanks very much for keeping the faith and for your recent emails, some very good ones I've had in recently. No shout-outs on this edition, but I promise to do some in future editions. And I do see all of your emails, unlike a lot of the mainstream media, who take emails from you and then don't read them. I do. Some of the recent emails have been saying, Howard, where are you? So let me explain. You know that I've had some health problems that I've been dealing with. They're ongoing. We're still trying to get to the bottom of it all. It's been a little tedious and time-consuming. It means I've missed some work. Now, if you work for yourself, like I do, as a freelance, then you realize that if you miss work, you have to do more shifts to make up for the money that you lost. Otherwise, you can't pay the bills. So some of the work that I do doesn't pay anything more than tossing burgers in McDonald's does, you know, although I love it and it's fun, but it means that I just have to do a fair amount of work to make up. So that's what I've been doing recently, and I hope you understand that's how things are. Plus, of course, with The Unexplained, a lot of the competing shows, or certainly the ones that are in the same segment or sector, they're paid for content. So those people do it as their job. I've kept this show free, so I have to have other work to be able to pay all the expenses of doing this, which is something that we've talked about a lot in the past. So all of those things together sort of make a perfect storm whenever I'm whenever I'm incapacitated for whatever reason. It's very boring, but I guess it had to be explained. On this edition of the show, two guests. Richard C. Hoagland talking about his life's work, his magnum opus. It's a new project, including a lot of top-line researchers who've helped him with it. He's going to talk about it here, so I want to get your thoughts about him when he's been on. Plus, a man who made a lot of the national newspapers in this country and a lot of newspapers and media around the world in the last couple of weeks. I think we did the first interview with him here at The Unexplained about his research into the messages of crop pictures, not crop circles. The correct term, Dr. Horace Drew says, is crop pictures, not crop circles. Now, I always was very suspicious about crop circles, and I thought a lot of them were faked. He believes the number of fakes is very tiny, and that a lot of these things, and look at how complex many of them are, that they can't possibly be fakes, and they have clear mathematical scientific messages for us. Anyway, you'll hear him in minutes from now. After Richard C. Hoagland, Dr. Horace Drew in Australia, academic researcher, and somebody I think you should hear coming up on The Unexplained. Like I say, thank you for keeping the faith with me and with all of this. I'm getting back up to speed, so please keep checking in on the website and all the rest of it. And when you get in touch with me, by the way, tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use the show. Because you know I love to hear from you, but I love to know where you are and the way that you use this show. Because I know you're doing all kinds of things while you're listening to this. Okay, Richard C. Hoagland first, then talking about his life's work, his magnum opus. Creating this massive work are a number of people that Richard wanted me, before we get him on here, to credit, understandably. Those people are Kinthia, Keith Laney, Bob Harrison, Andrew Curry, Will Farrar. Those are the names. So important to Richard that this man, Will Farrar, held himself up for days at a time, barely eating or sleeping, poring over the latest space images from NASA and other space agencies, making calculations, comparing files. Richard believes the final product brings together disparate views and theories, uniting them in their fundamental source data and ultimately universal revelation. Boy, that's a build-up and a half. Richard C. Hoagland, Dick, how are you?
Good evening, Howard. After that, how can we even do a show?
Well, you know, that is, I don't think anybody's had a build-up like that on this show. What's this about rock star? I've known you for, as I said to my listeners, the thick end of 20 years. I didn't know you were a rock star. Is that so?
Well, that's kind of, you know, here, neither here nor there. When I was advising Cronkite, we had a musical group called The Foregone Conclusion, my brothers and sisters, and we signed to Columbia Records. It wasn't Capitol, it was Columbia. And the kind of, you know, climax of that was I was advising Cronkite on going to the moon, and there was a Christmas party, I think 68, 69, somewhere around there, and we wound up singing at the CBS News Christmas party. So that was the first time that Walter discovered I had a secret life.
Wow. And, you know, for those in the United Kingdom, our American listeners right now, of course, know who Cronkite is. He's one of my heroes. He was the man who announced the murder of John F. Kennedy. He was the man who was there live throughout the moon missions. He was perhaps the single most famous news anchor there has ever been.
Well, he was known here and actually around the world as the most trusted man in America, because that was a time when we actually believed in news. The idea of fake news would have never crossed his lips. There was incredible checking. I mean, I was there in the trenches. I saw the kind of checking that went on before anything was put on the air. I remember meetings with producers. We had a woman producer back at a time when women in any profession were very rare. Her name was Joan Richmond, and I remember sitting in a meeting with her and our executive producer and a whole bunch of other people, and there was a serious discussion about who to put on the air, because who we put on the air automatically became an authority for millions and millions of Americans, if not people around the world. So the recipe for credibility, the recipe for integrity, the recipe for believability was in vetting the people you put on the air. And I must say, when I see television now, that incredible integrity that Walter brought to the industry, to the news business, seems to have gone by the board.
Right. Things have changed enormously, and not always for the better. I mean, we've got an awful lot more choice now than we had, but I don't know whether we know anymore.
Well, the problem is we have choice, but we don't have any brains behind it. In other words, when you go on the internet, as I said to Art once in an early show we did, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog, meaning that your dog could be typing, and at the other end, you think it's someone who's credible, when in fact, it's someone who has something to sell you, someone who has a political agenda, someone who has been bought and paid for. I mean, it's really almost impossible for the average person, I won't say American because this applies to the entire planet now, for the average person to go on the internet and know what to believe.
Well, that's a double-edged sword, isn't it, Dick? That is a double-edged sword for all of us, because look, I have, as you have, a big internet presence. You know, I do a podcast and I have an audience around the world. You do The Other Side of Midnight. You have an audience that is loyal in the United States, and is...
We're in 160-some countries.
Yeah, exactly.
And that responsibility to me, having been brought up on Cronkite, having worked with the man, every time I go on the air, I mean, I spend so much time with every program, people have asked, well, why have you disappeared? We haven't disappeared. We're on hiatus. And the answer is because I could not do a five-night-a-week show at the level that I strongly am committed to and do this book with my other authors, which sometimes is like herding cats. It's impossible to do two things, to serve two masters. So we've been on hiatus for a few months. We're coming back live soon. I heard you mention the book will be out in 2 days. I don't know where you got that.
Didn't you write that a couple of days, whatever? But when is the book out?
Well, when it's done.
When it's done, you're still doing it.
It's the old Gallo wine commercial. Make no wine before it's time. This is, as you said, the magnum opus. This is the climax of 35, 40 years of my research and of the research of a whole bunch of people on the bridge crew, on our team. By the way, you forgot one, Tim Saunders. I want to mention Tim Saunders, who's doing incredible things behind the scenes, and it will all become public pretty soon. This is organizing a multidisciplinary research effort, putting it in pages, in hard copy, while we also are creating a series of videos and PowerPoints that will begin the campaign to show people what it is we found. This is the climax of 30 to 40 years of this research, and it's got to be right. You know, there was an old Zenith commercial. You can tell how old I am. Mm-hmm. You know, the quality goes in before the name goes on. We're not putting this out until it's right, because its conclusions are so incredibly explosive, and we will be able to stand behind them. The documentation, which is what Cronkite taught me, document, 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 get at least three sources. And when you're trying to find sources that are thousands of years old in ancient Egyptian history, like Manetho, the 3rd century BC Greek Heliopolitan priest who put together the first Egyptian history, it's kind of hard to check him against Herodotus, who was a 5th century BC Greek historian. So that's what's taking the time, because when I put this out there and the team puts this out there, I want it to be bulletproof, because the conclusions are going to change the future. Thank God.
No, look, we're tantalizing our audience here, and I want to come to all of this after we've taken our first break of this hour, then we'll get rightly stuck into it. I just want to establish your credentials for people in the United Kingdom who might not know you. I know that you have a massive profile in the US, and I also know that you've got people in those 167 countries champing at the bit to get you back on air. You've had to take a brief break from the other side of midnight to get the book done, but let's just paint the picture of you. Now, you were the man behind The Face on Mars. That got you international coverage. It also got you brickbats and criticism that, as we know, continues to this day. I mean, I used to put you on the air and I used to say, you've got so many followers and so many people who love you. And you would give me a quick reality check and say, yeah, Howard, but I've also got a lot of other people who say Richard Hoagland makes stuff up.
Well, they say that about everybody. Look at what they're doing with our current president. I mean, the attacks are extraordinary, and the evidence is still lacking. So in this internet era where people don't know who to trust, it basically falls to those with the loudest voices, those with the most convincing smile, those with the ability to persuade. I'm trying to do it by old school. I'm trying to do it by the data. So the data is there. We know it's there. It's astonishing data. And it only will be believed when we sign off on all the imagery, all the analysis, all the expertise, put it between covers, put it out there, and then are able to defend it.
And can you, we'll go into all of this, obviously, after we've taken that break. But before we take that break, can you give me an idea as to whether this work ties in thematically with everything else you've done? For example, the presentation that you gave when I was there in Liverpool. In fact, I was instrumental in getting you invited to Liverpool to present about what might be within the rings of Saturn.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Howard, you have a wonderful memory. Yes.
You gave, well, listen, I've just got to say to my listener here that you gave something I've never seen anybody do without umming or erring or deviating or hesitating. You gave, I think it was a 3-hour, maybe more presentation backed with images behind you. It was utterly flawless, and that audience in Liverpool at the Beyond Knowledge conference, it's a few years ago now, was spellbound and silent, Richard. You know, it's not an easy thing to do, and you can do it.
Well, thank you. That data, by the way, is being confirmed. I've been waiting very patiently. Remember, that was back in 2004, 2005. It's now 2017. God, how time flies when you're having fun. And NASA is putting the Cassini spacecraft from which those images came in its final plunge into Saturn. It's got about, I think, 10 months, 11 months left before they put it into the atmosphere so they don't hit any of the moons like Enceladus, which may have life under its icy crust. And in those final orbits, those huge, long elliptical orbits that take weeks to complete one, they're coming down past the rings and getting extraordinary high-resolution images never available before of the very structures we found on those early Cassini images back in 2005. So if you're a little patient, they will not be in this book. They'll be in the next book, because we're going to do a series of these on what NASA and the other space agencies have really found all around the solar system that they haven't felt you, the British people, the American people of the world, are ready to see. And that goes back to something called Brookings, which we'll talk about when we come back from the break.
Right. Okay. And what you said in Liverpool, you know me, journalist, I boil everything down like a kettle boiling to nothing, was effectively that there are structures and things within the rings of Saturn that missions like the current one will reveal. I suppose the big question is, if high-res pictures of these things do emerge, in this day and age when we're getting prepared for the possibility of life elsewhere, will we be told?
Well, eventually, we have to be told. I mean, our political timetable, and again, this is so subject to nuance and to, you know, qualitative reasoning, says that 2017 is the year. Sometime between now and the end of the year, we will be told. Now, how much we will be told, I don't know. Who will tell us? I don't know.
Might it be Mr. Trump who will tell us?
Well, it's so interesting because he signed a NASA authorization the other day, first time in 7 years that a president has actually signed a bill funding NASA as part of a larger budget, as opposed to just, you know, the Congress passing what's called a continuing resolution. And he funded NASA to the tune of $19.5 billion.
Now, for reasons that we'll get into, 19.5 is a very significant figure, because literally that number, 19.5, is recurring everywhere.
Everywhere. And who knows? He may have briefings behind the scenes. We have conversations that we're looking forward to, perhaps with some of his advisors. He won't make the move for lack of knowledge, I can tell you that.
This is your magnum opus. How do you combine the two things of telling your life story, explaining to people your purpose, and also revealing what you say is startling and game-changing, your phrase, information? How do you mix those things in this book?
Well, one thing before we get into that, don't forget The Other Side of Midnight. That's a key, important website that we want people to pay attention to, because that's where the membership for Club 19.5 is gathered. That's where we're going to be giving people updates. That's where, you know, copies of this program will be available for those that can't listen live. And the videos, as I said, that we're producing that are kind of the rollout for the book. The book, by the way, is called Hidden Mars, A War in Heaven. And one thing, Howard, this is not a story about me. I'm kind of incidental. I've just followed this because it's the only thing. When you stumble over a huge truth, you can do one of two things. You know, as Winston Churchill said, you can either, you know, stumble and pick yourself up and move on, or you can stop and pay attention. And I decided to stop 30, 40 years ago and pay attention. And it's only because the material is so incredibly important and so real and so determinative of the future of the human species that I've been persistent in this. So this is not a book about me. This is a book about the work. It's a book about the research. It's a book about humanity.
But you are the work, Richard.
No, there's a whole bunch of other people, and you mentioned some of their names at the top of the show. They've been doing as much as I have for almost as long. They just haven't had the public exposure because, frankly, not everybody is, shall we say, equipped to deflect the awful attacks that come at you when you try to change a paradigm. And for all those haters out there, and I know I've got them, you know, I have offered to pay for their psychoanalysis bills, because if they really believed all the nonsense they've been saying, then they're in for a shock. Because almost everything I've said, remember, I didn't ever say 100%, but almost everything turns out to be true. And the things that turn out not to be true turn out to be far more interesting and complex. So the truth is even stranger than I have thought, you know, for the last 10, 20, 30 years.
Sounds to me like you've reached a stage in your life, Dick, that you want to stake your credibility, your reputation, everything on one thing. And it sounds to me like this is the throw of the dice.
But see, I don't see it that way. Hmm? To me, it's, look, when you're a data-oriented guy, when you were brought up at Walter Cronkite's knee, because when I was advising him, I was in my early 20s. Can you imagine? Mm-hmm. You know, I remember sitting in the control room, afraid to touch anything for fear that I would throw the entire CBS television network off the air. Mm-hmm. You develop a philosophy that you're part of the main, you're part of the wave, you're part of how history is unfolding. If it hadn't been for me, it would have been someone else. I really don't have an ego in this, because the information itself is so extraordinary and so informative of who we are and who we can become again. So why don't we get into it? Why don't we talk about how this all began?
The last conversation we had about Mars, we agreed that there were things on the surface of Mars, according to the pictures that we have been sent, and they may not be the whole story, that look like regular geometry, that suggests that things created by something or someone had been there before. That's where we left things. Where are we now?
Well, where are we now is we're seeing everyday implements. We're seeing things like ranges and toasters and ovens and shoes and all kinds of things that human beings use in every day. And the stunning thing is we're finding them on Mars. We're finding them encrusted with dirt, embedded in rock. We're finding them fossilized, meaning that there was an extraordinary catastrophe. and human civilization, what we think of as shopping malls and voting for president and talking on the internet, apparently we've all done this before, except on a whole other world. And at some point in time, a group of us came from Mars to Earth to begin again. Now, that's a stunning set of statements in about 30 seconds, every one of which will be defended and documentation provided in this new book.
Now, I've heard people say those things before, but they've never been able to roll out scientific evidence for it. And I'm guessing, is that the game-changing information that you
yes,
have?
Yes. So NASA has been playing a two-tiered game for 50 years, ever since it was born. It's obviously had a hidden mission, to quote my friend Keith. Part of the mission has been to go and find, where no one has gone before, our own history. And the other part has been to dissemble to the world about what they were really doing while they pretended to be doing a whole bunch of other stuff. This has all come down now to this mission, this incredibly nuclear-powered rover mission on the surface of Mars at a place called Gale Crater, where this little rover, I say little, it's about the size of a VW, powered by nuclear energy so it can keep going and going and going like the Energizer Bunny. We estimate that if nothing broke on it, it could go for 100 years before it would need power. So this thing has been taking imagery and doing scientific analyses at two tiers, one for the in crowd and one for the public. And over the last several years, they have been opening the door a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, and revealing to the public in this incredible file of imagery what they're actually finding. Now, why aren't there headlines? Why isn't Donald Trump running on a campaign of sending humans to Mars day after tomorrow? Because we live in a culture, Howard, where unless an authority figure tells us the truth, we don't believe it. And what we opened the show with about the demise of three networks and people like Cronkite, we're now in an era where if it's on the internet, it's there, it's public, it's available, and who the hell believes it? Because every voice is equal, and when every voice is equal, no voice has supremacy, and no one is believed. This is what we've done to ourselves. We've created a culture where everything is available and nothing is believable because no one knows who to believe because they don't have a process for finding truth in and of themselves.
A man who we both know, called Seth Shostak from the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, told me, I've spoken to him a couple of times, and I know you know of him, that if we were
I
to discover somebody...
He's actually written about me.
Well, there you go. You know, he said, if we were to discover something staggeringly game-changing, the news would be straight out there. But you're telling us that there has been a two-tier game played here, where exploration has been done, and the powers that be know stuff, and the rest of us are being led slowly by the nose to revelation.
Well, we have to go back, I think, 50 years, actually 60 years, to when NASA was first born in 1958. By act of President Eisenhower and an act of Congress, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration was created as a civilian space agency, because up until that time, for the few years before, we'd had competition between military services. The Russians had launched the first Sputnik, the first satellite into Earth orbit. There was a huge outcry in the so-called free world. Oh, we're behind the Russians, we're behind the Soviets, we got to catch up. And so Eisenhower came in, said we're going to have a civilian space agency to handle space. And everybody applauded, and we thought that was the end of militarization of space. Turns out that's not true at all. NASA is actually, if you read the charter carefully, a division of the American Defense Department. It operates under the rules of secrecy, national security. The final people who sign off on NASA data are the president's national security establishment, the Defense Department, the Secretary of Defense. So everything that NASA puts out there is technically civilian, but actually has been run through filters, so nothing that would disturb what we here term national security would get published. And it's right in the charter. So when you start with a lie, when you start with the lie that NASA is civilian, it turns out that that lie has now been extended to cover all the interesting good stuff it's found, because at the same time NASA was created, there was a private think tank here in Washington called the Brookings Institution, which NASA turned to with a contract to basically study what it should do and what the impact would be on human civilization. It's called, the shorthand is called the Brookings Report. You can find it on theenterprisemission.com. Just search on Google for Brookings and Enterprise. It'll take you to it. And basically, it says, bottom line, if we find it, we must hide it because they can't take it. Meaning reality, evidence supporting the fact that we are not alone. So NASA was created in a lie. It was created basically to demur, to put off the day when there would be a reckoning, because Brookings also said, we can't tell them until they are prepared.
All right.
So the Brookings people, the Brookings Institution, all these eggheads, as we used to call them, who were brought together under this NASA contract, basically laid out a game plan for how to prepare the human race for the reality that we're going to talk about this evening.
Now, are you telling me that every U.S. president has been part of this, quotes, lie?
I don't know.
Well,
I really don't know.
You're implying that that's the case. How much do we think that Mr. Trump knows?
Well, remember, we know there was a breakpoint in briefing of presidents when Bill Clinton came in. There were people actually who told him, Bill Clinton himself told us, that he was not fully briefed on some things. He sent out an emissary. Remember the lawyer from Arkansas that he sent out? I forget his name off the top of my head. He asked him, he commissioned him to find out two things. One is, who killed Kennedy? And the second was, are UFOs / ETs, the ET reality, real? And he reports back, this person, a lawyer who I can't remember his name, to the president, and he tells him, I can't find out anything on anything of those two critical subjects. So the establishment inside has stonewalled presidents from Clinton on. We think that Eisenhower had to know. We think that Kennedy knew. It may have been that's why Kennedy was killed. That's a whole other program. We know that George Bush probably knew because he was head of the CIA for a while, and the CIA is very, very instrumental in developing the diversionary discussions, the so-called Richardson panel back in the 50s on UFOs, etc., that kept people from thinking that ETs and UFOs and extraterrestrials were actually real. They were always the giggle factor. You know, you've done stories, Howard, on the BBC where you do a kicker at the end of the show and it's a giggle factor UFO story, right?
Well, less so these days, but yes.
Less so these days, but that was the wisdom. Always dismiss it. Always use it with a smile or a smirk. Never take it seriously. And the evidence is extraordinary, but no one's allowed to see it because they are deflected by a screen of public policy that says belittle it in every way possible and demean it in every way possible. Now, we've been attacking some of the internet problems. The good news about the internet is that the information is out there if you know how to dig. The problem is that when you dig and you dig and you dig and you find in your own reality, oh my God, this stuff is real. If you try to tell your neighbor, your son, your mother, your granddaughter, if they are watching mainstream media, they will not believe you because the fix has been in for decade after decade because Brookings said in their final conclusion, remember this was an official NASA government document report, if we find it, we can't tell them because they can't take it because, and this was actually the line in the report, this information could destroy human civilization.
But you said that we are being led towards the revelation, that it's happening bit by bit.
That's
Brookings said we weren't ready.
We weren't ready 50 years ago.
Right, and so why are we ready now?
Because there's been this 50-year educational program. Now, what Brookings recommended is that educators and politicians and eggheads, you know, experts in various fields, get together and craft a public policy education program through movies, through television, through school programs, through public policy statements that would gently bring people along. And that's why we got Star Trek, we got Star Wars, we got, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. We got all the upgrade from the fear porn movies of the 50s where, you know, aliens were here to eat our face off. And now there's a mixture. There's good aliens and bad aliens. We have Star Wars. We have a huge hidden history masquerading as a film. I personally think, based on the evidence we found, that Star Wars and, the guy who was behind it, basically is trying to tell us this is our own history, except it's not in a galaxy far, far away. It's in this solar system millennia ago, from which we have suffered a kind of gross cultural, you know, amnesia, to where we can't be in touch with the truth because it's so awful to our personal realities that we have basically blocked it out. When people try to tell us this is real, you'll notice the reaction. People giggle, people smirk, people, you know, demur. Few people take it seriously. And those who do, they're then led off into a blind canyon by all the fake news in this arena that's been carefully crafted by the intelligence agencies, so the truth is never taken seriously. I'm hoping that in this year, 2017, which all the numbers now say is the year, the powers that be believe that that educational program has gone far enough to where we will not freak out. We will not destroy civilization if it comes out that we are not alone. And we have an extraordinary history beginning right next door on the moon and then on Mars, where there is evidence, NASA and other space agency evidence, that overwhelmingly proves the case. All you got to do is look, because an authority figure at the moment is not stepping forth. That may happen, but in the meantime, we're on our own to look at this data and make our own analysis. And my question is, are people educationally equipped to know what they're looking at if they actually go and look?
And do you believe, as we get to another one of those commercial breaks, that we have both sides of the Atlantic, do you believe that the final act in this drama is going to be played out in your lifetime and my lifetime?
Well, I think it's imperative that it be played out, because otherwise I think we're going to wind up in destroying ourselves in World War III. I mean, Howard, look at all the evidence. Look at the incredible contretemps being placed between the Russians and the new American administration. Look what this wild idiot in North Korea is doing. They're now telling us that there's satellite evidence of frenetic activity for another nuclear test.
Yeah, but we always had despots and fools, though, didn't we?
Yeah, but they didn't have nuclear weapons. And if that guy is able to put a nuclear weapon on top of a rocket and take out Seattle, you understand that's the end of civilization.
Right, so something has to head this off at the pass, and it has to be something way bigger than any of that back chatter. W.J. Smith, thank you very much for your tweet. Apparently, and here's information for both of us, the Clinton attorney who was deputed was Webster Hubble.
Yes, Webster Hubble.
Thank you for that. And
no
Anthony,
relation to the Hubble telescope. Hubble.
It would have been nice if that was the case. Some kind of synchronicity there. And Anthony, thank you very much for your tweet. The tweet that I've just had, Richard, will lead into this. This is from Ian. And Ian says, and you've heard this kind of stuff before, so it's not going to be a shock. He says, Richard C. Hoagland is saying the same things he said last time you spoke to him. I'm still waiting for something new. I think he's about to get it. Yep.
For the people who've been supporting this work, who are the membership of Club 19.5 at theothersideofmidnight.com, we're providing the information to them first, because without their support, I mean, they've been paying now for months for a program which is not on the air live. Thousands of people have been supporting this research so that I and my team can finish, you know, bring this across the finish line in a way that it has to be done. Mm. Otherwise, no one will believe it. Those people get this information first. They deserve it. They're our supporters. They're the people who kept this going in the final home stretch.
Of course, a lot of that is about you, isn't it? Because you were, look, I can look back 20 years, my first computer, that dial-up connection, you and Art Bell in the nighttime together. You know, there is a 20-year loyalty and interest built up.
Well, also, for that tweeter, by the way, Walter Cronkite would never have said tweet, ever, ever.
Would he have had another word for it?
Who knows, for that tweeter, all he has to do is, you know, become a member of Club 19.5, and he's going to get this first.
All right.
If he doesn't want to do that, he can go, and the documents are in public domain. There's thousands, tens of thousands of pages of documentation on the Enterprise mission for free. Just start reading. I've been putting everything out there after we put out the two books spaced, 20 years apart. Most of this data is out there, again, for free, but you got to want to go and look. And most of the critics that I deal with, they are so afraid of looking because it will change their worldview and their lives will never be the same if they take this seriously, that they would prefer to stay on the sidelines and tweet That's very appropriate. Instead of actually doing any homework. You got to do your homework. If you don't do your homework, you will be left in the dust of history.
All right. For Ian and for all your American listeners and for all the listeners in the UK and Europe, it's time, isn't it? What is the game changer?
Well, let me begin by going 30, 40 years back and tell everyone how this began, because we have no memory. We have no cultural memory. I was, as you have said several times during the show, an advisor to Walter Cronkite, CBS, and I went to California to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in the summer of 1976 to witness history, to witness the first unmanned landing of a spacecraft on the planet Mars, the Viking 1 lander. And I sat there in the middle of the night. On my left was Eric Burgess, a well-known countryman of yours. He founded the British Interplanetary Society with my old friend Arthur Clarke. And on my right was another friend. His name was Gene Roddenberry. And we sat there with thousands of people from all over the world, correspondents, news people from literally almost every country on Earth, with bated breath waiting for the first images to come in after the soft landing of Viking 1 on July 20th of 1976. So the image comes in one line at a time and slowly creeps across the big screen. When the image is done, which is a close-up of the foot pad of the lander, the engineers didn't want a view of the landscape. They wanted a view of the ground so they can see if the spacecraft had sunk into the dirt. You know, engineers always want practical things. When that first photograph came in, that historic picture, Roddenberry, on my right, jumps up in front of this auditorium with a couple of thousand people and yells, "Cut! Print!" Because it was a movie. It was an unfolding real movie. Well, the story kind of shifted over the next few days, and about 5 days later, there was a NASA press conference in the same auditorium, and one of the project scientists, his name was Jerry Soffin from the Viking mission, presented on the screen a huge blow-up of what looked to be a very quirky humanoid face on Mars, taken from orbit, looking down by the Viking 1 orbiter, which had released as a mother craft the lander which had landed 5 days before. And that was the beginning for me of an extraordinary search. Was that face, in fact, just as NASA said, a trick of light and shadow, a quirk, a chimera, or was it, you know, the harbinger of something totally extraordinary? Why should there be a human face on another planet? I mean, evolutionary biologists like George Gaylord Simpson in the 60s at Harvard said categorically over and over again, if we ran the history of Earth again from 5 billion years ago to now, we would never get us. We would never get human beings with two arms, two legs, mouth, eyes, etc., etc. We might have intelligent squid. We might have intelligent cicada. We might have intelligent cockroaches, but we would never get hominids looking like us. That was the religion of cultural, random, Darwinian evolution. So for an image to come in from a NASA spacecraft, first mission to Mars to land, and for that image to be of us, a humanoid, recognizable being with two eyes, mouth, nose, etc., was impossible by everything that science knew in 1976. Now, it's still impossible by everything science thinks they knows. The problem is that theory has to take backseat to data. And the data said this was real. Why does it say it was real? Because unlike the official NASA pronouncement that it was a trick of light and shadow, and when we took a look at it a few days later, it had all gone away because the sunlighting had changed. What I found, and two gentlemen independently, Vince DiPietro and Greg Molinar, who were engineers working for another NASA center on the East Coast, remember JPL's on the West Coast in Pasadena, these guys worked at the Goddard Space Flight Center, where I actually was a consultant many years later, and they found in their off time, they went through all the photographs that have been archived, hard copy 8x10 glossies in huge filing cabinets in this room at Goddard. They went through on their lunch breaks and after hours, and they finally found a second image of the face on Mars. And it was taken at a different time of day, different sun angle. It was taken about 30 days after the first image, and it was still there at a different lighting. They had a stereo pair.
And so yet, scientifically, it has to be something like that, you would say, because if it's lit in a different way and it wasn't a face, it wouldn't look like that.
Exactly. It would have been a trick of light and shadow. Well, we got involved and I organized this independent Mars investigation, and that's all in the, you know, the book, The Monuments of Mars, and all its five editions, because we kept finding new stuff and putting out new editions back in the 80s and 90s. We finally got independent computer image people like Dr. Mark Carlotto, who basically wrote the book on something called shape from shading techniques. And he was able to take the digital imagery of these two separate Viking images, put them in a computer, and come up with a 3D model, which showed it was a face. Now, separate from Mark's work, at the other end of the country, back in California, Kinthea, who was an artist who you're going to learn a lot about when you read, you know, this book, Hidden Mars, The War in Heaven, Kinthea was doing physical modeling from these two images in clay. She spent weeks and weeks and weeks painstakingly physically modeling in old-fashioned clay sculpture techniques this same image that Carlotto had worked on digitally. And when you compare them, and the comparisons are in the book, they were the same. Her technique, which was hundreds of years old, 3D sculpturing, and his digital technique, which was what, 3-4 years old, you know, part of the computer revolution, they turned out with the same data to create the same result. Again, any scientist will tell you, if you have totally independent people doing totally independent work and they come to the same conclusion, you take it seriously.
So
nobody has taken this seriously because the fix is in.
Right. All this was happening while the rest of the world had been told, nothing to see here, walk on by.
Exactly. And that's where the politics come in, because Brookings said, if this kind of stuff hit the fan too soon, mixing our metaphors madly, we would destroy civilization. I mean, look, the New York Times on December 16th, 1961, it's burned in my memory, actually came out with an abbreviated public version of the Brookings Report. And they said in a headline, go check it out. It's archived on enterprisemission.com. You can also Google, you know, December 16th, 1961, New York Times. They said, government studies says if aliens found, humans will destroy civilization. That's pretty potent stuff to people that know nothing and basically are terrified of their own shadows if they vote wrong and their constituents don't like what they're doing. That's what politicians do. They're supposed to follow what their constituents want. Well, who would want to be responsible for destroying civilization if the New York Times told you that's what would happen if you took the face on Mars seriously?
Gee.
That was all 30, 40 years ago.
So the stakes of the game are huge. So where do you want to take me next?
Well, we set the background. This saga began for me personally with the face on Mars and NASA basically not telling the truth. Because it turned out Jerry Soffin, and I knew Jerry. I actually had an incredible trip with him and his wife to San Francisco in the subsequent days to that little press conference. And I got to know him very well. We hung out together. We talked about stuff. But he would never talk about the face on Mars seriously. About a decade later, when we were about 10 years later, the occasion came up for a celebratory dinner in Washington, D.C., of all the Viking scientists and project people to kind of, you know, compliment themselves, pat themselves on the back, like the Academy Award does with stars and movies, for a job well done. And lo and behold, Jerry Soffin invited me to present a keynote speech at the 10th anniversary Viking dinner. And I showed him with a Reagan presidential advisor, David Webb, in a downtown Washington hotel room. I previewed what I was going to talk about, which was the data we had collected on the reality of Cydonia, which is where the face on Mars lives, on Mars, and the ancillary structures, pyramids, geometric aligned streets, and kind of a cityscape, etc. And all of that was mind-boggling to him, because 10 years down the road, for some reason, he was more open to taking the idea possibly as real, or at least as worthy of pursuit. So he invited me to speak at, to do the keynote at this Viking 10th anniversary dinner. Day later, I get a phone call. Everything was off. I was disinvited. And it's been that way ever since, Howard. Someone somewhere high up does not want this taken seriously. Jerry Soffin soon found his wife, who he cherished above everything on earth, floating face down in their pool.
My God.
Dead. And he never did anything in public again, and he died very unhappy and obviously shattered. These guys play rough. I mean, we fast forward the film back about 1998. I was in Florida, and a Fox special came on that I had been very actively behind the scenes involved in on ancient Egypt, and I had found a set of artifacts in ancient Egypt at a place called Abydos. Does that name ring a bell?
Tell me.
Abydos. It's a key planet in Stargate SG-1.
All right.
Brookings, Abydos. Abydos is where the hidden history of the human race is literally limbed out in a temple built by Seti I, something like 1400-1500 years BC, I believe. Anyway, in Abydos, there is a lintel up against the ceiling where there's a whole bunch of very modern-looking things like helicopters and tanks and ground speeders and other things that have no business being depicted in ancient Egypt. Good grief, no. I sent a producer with AK-47 guards on camels hundreds of miles across the desert with Fox cameras to record this and put it on Fox television. And I looked into the camera, because we tape various parts of this separately, and I said, if this is real, it means we are the Martians. This was 1998. A few days later, three guys show up and live in the hotel room next to mine. And they park their blue truck, which was battered with paint, looked like they were painters, out in front. And they sit out in front. And when I and Robin would come and go from my room there in Florida, they would literally sit behind their window, their big window where they'd pulled the blinds wide open, or sit in front at the little table in front of each window that the hotel had set up, you know, for, I guess, afternoon cocktails. And they would glare hate at us, at me. 3 days after this started, I woke up at the crack of dawn in the morning with an incredible feeling that I had an elephant on my chest. And from then, I was whisked to the hospital. I was told, Robin was told behind the scenes that they gave me up for dead, that basically I had less than 50-50 chance. She brought me through with all kinds of medicinals, which, you know, if you want to get better from something serious, you should get hold of Dr. Robin Falkov. Anyway, long story short, someone, Howard, tried to kill me because I'd been on Fox television with evidence looking into the camera and saying, not only are we not alone, but we are the Martians. We somehow came from Mars to Earth. Actually, we came back, and that's part of the long history we'll talk
and
about in
you
this book.
Believe that the information
it's not about
was...
belief. It's not about belief, Howard. Right. It's about when evidence.
We're talking about the heart attack. You believe that somebody regarded what you were doing as so ahead of its time and so beyond the program as it was set out to take us along this journey at their speed, not yours, that they were willing to stop you with a staged heart attack.
Yes, because the same night, literally, the same night in England, Stanley Kubrick died. March, I forget what the exact date of 1998. Now, when I noticed that I'd almost been killed and they had succeeded in killing Stanley, because I think he was murdered, I started looking into the background of, you know, the numerology, the ritual part of this that we haven't talked about on this show, but we have on previous shows. Do you know that Stanley died and I was attacked exactly 666 days before the beginning of 2001? And what was the theme of 2001? It's when humankind finds out it's not alone. Arthur and Stanley crafted that document, that incredible film, and then Arthur wrote the novel based on the idea that we would ultimately be allowed in to see that we are not the first, that the human race is part of a much bigger continuum of reality out there.
Right, so Stanley Kubrick died on March the 7th, 1999, I'm being told.
Yeah, that was when I went to Miami in 98, and then it was early 99 that I got the heart attack. So, yeah, it was that same night, March 7th. By the way, that March 7th date is also interesting because that's when I was up in an airplane, a KC-135, a few years earlier, chasing an eclipse for CBS News. Well, that's another story. Anyway, the point is that there are people that don't want this out.
So why are you continuing with it if you believe that your life is at stake?
Because I no longer think that's the case. I think history's moved on. I think too much is out there, and if they did kill me, it would only reaffirm everything I've been saying for 30-some years. You do not want to create martyrs. Never, ever create martyrs.
All right, which brings us to the kicker. Do you believe that you are now right man, right place, right time to deliver to us the game changer, and this is the 10 minutes of the show where we need to be getting to it?
Well, the book is the game changer. You know, the documentation we put in with my colleagues, my bridge crew, you know, is the game changer. The data is NASA. The data is ESA. The data is the Indian mission to Mars. The data is the Japanese mission to Mars. The data is evidence that has been allowed to leak out now, but no one talks about it. And if you've ever done any research on the internet, Howard, he says tongue-in-cheek, you know how incredibly complex it is to find anything and then to believe what you're finding. You know, I go back to the old Cronkite rule, three separate sources. The problem is that the separate sources on the internet all copy each other. So you can't really, unless you're incredibly tenacious, find separate sources. The good news is the NASA archives are available. The NASA archives can be Googled by anybody. You can go and look at this data. They have tried to do what our friend Will calls totally miscolorize the NASA imagery. It looks like what we call butterscotch puke. Do you really think that Mars looks that awful when you're there? Of course not. Early in the Curiosity mission, NASA put out what they call white balanced images. And lo and behold, Mars looks like the countryside I'm looking at this afternoon at after 5 o'clock in the afternoon here in the land of enchantment, New Mexico. It's got incredible crimson deserts. It's got rust-colored rocks. It's got incredibly bright blue skies sometimes. Mars is like Earth.
So why do they give us butterscotch puke then?
Because they've been faking the color for the last 50 years since Viking. Mm-hmm. Well, not quite 50.
All right. Now,
I know that. Because I was there when they started the fake of the color. I was standing in the lobby of the JPL Visitor Center, the Von Karman Auditorium, at the crack of dawn on July 21st. Remember, we landed pre-dawn hours of July 20th. About 24 hours later, we were going to get our first color picture from Mars, from Viking, the surface. And the picture comes in, and a whole bunch of us are standing around looking at the monitors, and I'm standing next to Carl Sagan. You know who Carl Sagan is. Mm. And he says, you know, tongue-in-cheek, wait till you see the borough enter stage left, you know, because it looked like Arizona. It had blue skies. It had pinkish deserts. It looked like an American desert. And then some technicians from JPL came around. They went all around the lab. And they changed the color on the monitors so the picture was blood red. All the blue, all the Earth-like appearance of this first color image. And at the press conference that evening, they claimed that, well, they had infrared leakage in some of the sensors.
You think
they had to color.
All of this is part of the deception. Now, look, I have to say that you still have not said enough to satisfy some of our listeners. Tweet in from Randy, who says, Howard, tonight you've been played.
Well, Randy has been playing himself. Sorry, Randy. You got to go read the stuff. Read Enterprise. Start at the beginning. Start at the beginning and read all the documentation on Enterprise. Read my previous books, you know, The Monuments of Mars and my book about NASA, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. Or you can be patient and you can wait for the new book, Hidden Mars, A War in Heaven, because the data and the documentation is there.
And look, you're saying this book is a game changer, and you are saying that politicians will act on this book.
Howard, hang on. There's no way in an hour radio show where we can't show pictures that I can convince anybody of anything. You got to go do your homework. It's free. You don't have to wait for this book. Go and look at everything I've done for the last 30 years, which is free in the public domain. If you're not convinced with tens of thousands of pages of that data, then wait patiently for the videos. The videos will be for the Club 19.5 membership. It's $5 a year. Those people deserve to have this information first because they have supported the end game. Or you can really wait another couple, 3 months till the book is ready. Then you can get a copy, buy a copy, spend a few dollars, and read it and see if I'm right or wrong. But I guarantee you we're right, because it's not just me. It's all the other independent investigators I put between the same covers. People like Keith Laney and Bob Harrison, who, by the way, is one of your countrymen. Kinthea and Will Farrer and Tim Saunders and Ron Gebron and a host of other people that you've never heard of. They've all been doing this stuff independently in parallel with me, and we've all reached the same conclusion.
Which is?
We are not the first. Human beings came from Mars, and in this book, I'm going to be able to do two things. I'm going to be able to give you a date when we came from Mars to Earth, an actual date supported by history, historical terrestrial documents. And two, I'm going to be able to lay out when the Martians who brought us, kidnapped some of us, and took us to Mars to basically tutor us in how to be civilized before we came back, I'm going to be able to give a date and a place and who the predecessors to us on Mars were, who basically rearranged the entire solar system and left the artifacts that Cassini is now photographing in the rings of Saturn, something like 500,000 years ago.
Okay, when this information is out there in this book, backed by all the data, what do you believe will happen?
Well, we have excellent inroads to the current administration. Okay. We're talking to several people who are very, very close to President Donald Trump.
And they're waiting for the book.
They are waiting for the data. Remember, it's not just the book. It's all the other ancillary information, starting with videos. Nobody reads anymore, Howard. They look at videos. They look at YouTube, okay?
True
enough.
So
we're packaging this in video form first with the bullet points. And if you want the documentation, you go get the book. If you don't care about documentation, you look at the imagery and the videos and you make your decision there. Or you go on the internet and you start looking for the original source data, which is NASA's open public archives, totally for free. But you got to press a few keys and go look.
Okay. Ian says he still hasn't heard anything new.
And he won't, because Ian doesn't want to hear.
Okay.
Ian is part of people who do not want to hear. Now, it could be that Ian used to live as his incredible time and some psychological blocks. It's called trauma. You know, it's called traumatic stress disorder. Suppose the human race, I mean, another one of your countrymen, Graham Hancock, has talked about cultural amnesia. And there was a guy named, I can't remember his name. He was the big planetary collision guy last century, in the 1950s. Names are escaping me this evening. Anyway, he wrote a book, several books, called, World in Collision. And he thought that the human race back then was suffering from some kind of huge cultural amnesia.
And if you think that's not possible, I'm talking to my listener here, just think about the way that cults use mind control. They use a thing called thought blocking. That's what you were talking about, isn't it? So when certain subjects are introduced, and I'm not saying this is what's happening, because I've got to sit in the middle here. That's my job.
I don't think this
that when certain subjects are introduced, you automatically go, no. Yeah?
Howard, I don't think this is being done by any agencies. I don't think this is mind control. I think this is internal filtering. If reincarnation is real, all right, a whole other program, and some of us lived on Mars, and we went through the catastrophe that forced us to flee and go to Earth, would we block it out? Would we live lifetimes where we don't want to remember because it was so awful and horrible? I mean, we're looking at nuclear war on Mars. We're looking at why Mars in history, in mythology, has been labeled the god of war.
All
we,
right.
The human race, conducted huge wars and ended ourselves on that planet, if the data is to be
all
believed.
Right. Now, Hedy is a regular listener and a scientist, okay, at quite a high level. Hedy has tweeted to say, Mars never had an O2 atmosphere long enough to evolve man. So none
and
of this is possible.
That's because he's believing who?
Right, so you're saying that the fundamentals of that are wrong.
Of course, the data's been jury-rigged. The data's been kept from us. You can't believe anything except for the imagery.
All right.
Stuart
is saying that there is no scoop here tonight. Where does the theory of evolution fit into all of this is a question from another tweeter.
Now, that's a really important, knowledgeable question. if this is real, if what we're claiming is real, and I'll give you one interesting data point that will back up that what I'm saying should be looked at. If what we're saying is real, evolution, at least in terms of human evolution, hominid evolution, goes out the window. All right? Let me give you the data point. Have you been tracking a group of people on Earth who are blind and who have something called non-24?
Mm-hmm.
You know what that is?
No.
It was found decades ago with spelunkers, people that would go down in caves and would cut themselves off from outside light, outside day-night cycles and all that. They'd be living underground for literally weeks, and they had no communication. And they found that they did not keep a 24-hour circadian rhythm clock.
Yes.
Their clocks drift. They drift. There's now a new syndrome for people who don't go down in caves, who are barely blind. Blind from birth or blind after birth, and they call it now, they have a name. Doctors have a name for everything now. It's called non-24, where because they can't see any outside stimuli, they can't see light, their internal circadian rhythm drifts relative to the 24-hour clock of the Earth's rotation. Guess what? It drifts in perfect synchronization with the Martian day.
All right, so in 30 seconds or so, if you can do it, how does that tie into the theory of evolution?
Because it's hyperdimensional. It's a trans-physical space connection between their genetic origins on another world in this solar system, Mars, which has a 24.66-hour day, and the Earth, which has a 24-hour day. And if you cut off the external stimuli, they revert to their genetic connection to Mars, linked via the physics that mainstream doesn't understand yet.
Well, that is fascinating. Look, there are a lot of people who are never going to be satisfied. Another tweeter, Del Monte, says he thinks that you're just selling stuff.
Of course, he would. He's part of the people that will never look. Look, go look. Simply go look. It's all free. You don't have to wait for the book. Go to Enterprise. It's all there totally for free. I put decades into Enterprise for free. This is not about making money. This is about making truth available.
Richard C. Hoagland, your thoughts on what he's had to say? Go to the website, theunexplained.tv, and you can contact me from there. And of course, Richard's main website is enterprisemission.com. Horace Drew. Dr. Horace Drew is a university academic researcher in Australia who's given a lot of his life to researching the meaning behind crop pictures, or what we used to call crop circles. I've been speaking with him.
I was 23 years in the CSIRO National Science Lab here in Australia, the Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organization, and I've been retired for about 5 years. I'm age 62 now. And I work for companies and consult and do things like that.
Right. And as you say, even today, there are people who poo-poo talk about crop circles for the very reason that we both know, and that I hinted at the top of this conversation, that there are people who fake them. And that has given crop circles a bad rap.
Yes.
Right. So it makes it a difficult area to go into. Why have you gone into it?
Well, that story about people faking them in the middle of the night and no one seeing them doing it, that's a very incorrect scenario for what's actually happening. That's sort of false reporting by the mainstream media. And that isn't really anything happening real at all. It's like a Santa Claus story.
But I have to say that there are some cases that have been filmed in this country by TV companies of people faking them. Now, the ones that come out of fakery like that don't look like the ones that you've put up online to see. The ones that you put up online to see are much more complex.
Those stories of fakery from many, many years ago, since about 2013 or 12. The farmers in Wiltshire became very aggressive. And if you go into a field now and without paying the farmer and fake a crop picture and you get caught, you're going to jail. So that's just dropped out completely for about 3 or 4 years. And the crop pictures continue to appear. Their numbers dropped by about 50%, but they continue to appear. And secondly, the complexity is just an order of magnitude greater for the real crop pictures versus the ones made as fakes. Obviously, anybody can go in the field and flatten things with a board. I mean, that's not a crop picture. But they have no intellectual content, and they have no, they just look terrible. So the difference is like kindergarten art versus Monet or something. So there's no comparison.
You said something very important there, Horace, that there were reports of these things being faked, and they were indeed faked. But the crop circles began to appear or continued to appear even after the fakery. And that's something the mainstream media, if we can call it that, a term that everybody's using these days, didn't reflect.
No, exactly right. So you've got that exactly right. After the fakery ended in about 2012 or 2013, for all purposes, last summer, for example, there were about 50 crop pictures around the world, not just in England, but around the world. And the best fake, the only really known fake, there were probably three fakes out of 50 in my view. The best was by Julian Richardson, which was the Audi car advertisement, which was nice, but it's not really this caliber of a real paranormal crop picture, even the best one. And there was one here in South Australia about a few weeks ago by the Japanese beer company, and it was an impressive crop picture, and it took them 40 men and $1 million in a week in daylight to make it. So it takes them to make a crop picture like the one we see 40 times, all those times a year in England. It took 40 men, $1 million in daylight, 5-7 days working to make. Now, that isn't what happens in England. In England, they may appear in 15 minutes, 30 minutes. So there's no comparison between the fakery and the real ones at this point.
In your research, have you seen them being created in 15 minutes?
I've never seen a crop picture made in 15 minutes. About half a dozen times, I've gone past a field with nothing in it. And then within an hour, and there's no people there in the middle of the, you know, just fields, in the middle of the nowhere. And then an hour later, there's a fairly spectacular crop picture there. I've had that happen half a dozen times, personally.
You are saying in this research that got reported all around the world that you have learned to decode them. You've learned to understand the messages that may be within them. How are you able to do that?
I've been studying them since about 2002, and naturally any scientist could have decoded them. We've decoded many of them since about 5 or 6 years from now, and their images, their articles all over the web, like best crop circle puzzles in all of history, best crop circle puzzles in all of history. That's one of my articles from 6 years ago. If you go there, I've got 20 of them precisely decoded, and they're like Sudoku puzzles. Once you learn how to do it, it's not that very hard at all. Some of them, of course, show images of the future. So if that happens, you don't really know how to decode it. But some of them show puzzles and things like that.
And how can you, when they show you a puzzle that you can decode and work it out, how do you know that you've worked it out?
Well, let's go for an example. Should we just have a specific example?
Yeah, totally. What I want to do, we're going to have to take some commercials here because that's the name of the game when you do this kind of radio. After that, I want to go through some specific examples with you, if you don't mind doing a few of those, because you've posted online some fabulous pictures of these crops. I'm calling them crop circles, and quite rightly, you're calling them crop pictures because that is what they are. But tell me about this one before we take that break.
Well, one famous one that all British people remember was in 2008, and it was in Barbary Castle, and for about a week, images went around the world. Nobody knew what it was, and then a retired professor in North Carolina, Mike Reed, saw a picture from North Carolina, and he sent an email to Linda Howe in Albuquerque saying, I've solved it. I didn't solve it, and then Linda sent it to me and said, is Mike Reed's solution correct? And I said, well, give me a couple of minutes, let me look at it, and I'll get back to you. So I said in about 10 minutes, yes, it is correct. And that one showed pi to 10 digits, 3.14159-2654, in a special form that no one on Earth had ever seen before, no mathematician. So I can say definitely you've solved it. And that was in all the British newspapers, pi to 10 digits. And that was an alien-made crop picture on it, there's no doubt.
If it was a form that had never been seen before, how did you know what it was?
No one knew. Just only 1 of 7 billion people on the Earth recognized the way it was. And they told Linda, and he told me. So it spread from one person on the Earth telling the other 7 billion.
And we'll get into who you think might be doing these things, as I say, in a little while. But let's just ask this question now. Why would anyone or anything anywhere imprinting these things on our land here? why would they want to give us the formula for pi, which we all learn at school, of course? Why would they give us that message as opposed to any one of a million other things they could say?
Well, there have been like hundreds of different messages. That's just one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but why that particular formula? I mean, what good would it do putting that there? What do you think whoever put it there is trying to prove?
That's just an educational tool trying to make us more intelligent, because the guys making it, the ET guys, are much smarter, and they're looking down on Earth seeing 7 billion humans, not very intelligent. And this is like we give Sudoku puzzles to people on their TV to think smarter. So they're trying to help us to think a little bit better, and there are quite a lot of puzzles of that kind, like 25% are like Sudoku puzzles from aliens. Believe me, this is true. I'm teaching us how to think better. And this is what you ask me, and I'll tell you the truth. That's what it is, okay?
Mm. No, it's fascinating that they would want to do that, and that they would want to give us an example from something that we're all taught at school, but in a way that makes us think differently about it.
Yes, exactly. And you remember the movie The Arrival, learning the alien language in the movie The Arrival, Amy Adams, she began to think quite differently. She could get psychic. And it's very similar to crop pictures. They're trying to change our ways of consciousness and thinking to get past tribal warfare, to get past all these stupid ways of thinking. As you know, you're on the news. I was just listening to all the terrible things people do on the news. So it's sort of elevate us and educate us into a better way of thinking. Probably about a quarter of crop pictures, that's the purpose of them.
All right, walk me through some of these pictures, then describe them to me.
I think the most famous one, we might as well go to 2002. Is that okay?
Yes, do it.
The Crabwood Farmhouse, the alien head and the binary code. Because this one's 100%, no one could possibly reproduce this with rope and boards. There's no one in all of history has even tried this. No one could do it. And it showed a big head of a gray alien. It's called an Orion gray alien. That's an ugliest looking fellow. And next to it was a CD, like we write music on a CD, you know, on a compact disc. And the CD had 1,368 binary digits arranged as a spiral. So you can't go around with a rope and board because it's a spiral. It's a changing distance from the center. It was done perfectly. It gave a long message to everybody. And that's a good example. That's an impossible to make that by. No one could possibly do that.
The two images then that are very much in popular culture, the CD is something that everybody can relate to. The alien is something that we've all seen in the movies.
And it pointed right toward, so there was a long message in the thing when you translate out of computer code into English. There were several messages. One, it says, beware the bearers of false gifts and their broken promises. That refers to the gray alien. Much pain, but still time. Believe there is good out there. We oppose deception. Mm-hmm. Conduit closing.
Conduit closing.
Now, the reason is from that message, we learned several things. That's a more typical message, the biggest one. First, beware the bearers of false gifts, their broken promises, refers to the Orion gray aliens who apparently made false gifts and promises to the U.S. government in secret, like alien technology. Mm. This is the implication.
It's a remarkable picture. The alien, and we've all seen these toy aliens in stores, it's that kind of head. This one looks both quizzical and a bit malevolent.
Malevolent, that's a good word, yeah, malevolent.
But at the same time. And you call this thing a CD. It's a disc of some kind.
It's a spiral, a long spiral with little zeros and ones, 1,368 of them. Perfectly around, you know, no one can ever do that. People have tried to grow more. It's completely impossible.
Now, this is the Crabwood crop circle. Where is this? What location is that? Where is Crabwood?
It's near Winchester. I don't know exactly. Crabwood Farmhouse, Sparshall.
That is Winchester. That's north. Well, that's mid Hampshire. That's just before you get to Southampton. That's staggeringly near from where this radio station is based in London, England. Yeah.
Yes. And actually, incidentally, the next thing says, we oppose deception. Now, you wonder, what is that? What's the deception? The crop picture pointed toward the BBC Winchester transmitter, implying that the radio TV signals were lying about crop pictures. This is the meaning. We oppose deception. It points to the radio TV BBC transmitter for BBC Winchester. That's what it's next to.
Now, that's an interpretation, though, isn't it?
No, it's a very accurate interpretation because there's a box next to the transmitter, mm-hmm. and they put a box in the crop picture which looks exactly the same. So they made a very artistic thing to say we're matching the shape of the landscape next to the transmitter. So it's a very accurate, I guess it's an interpretation, but it'd be a 90% interpretation.
Researcher Dr. Horace Drew in Australia talking about crop pictures and what they really might be trying to tell us and who might be behind them. Before that, Richard C. Hoagland about his new work, and we'll have more great guests in the pipeline, of course. The Unexplained continues at the website theunexplained.tv and in other places as well. Adam Cornwell is the person who gets the show out to you and maintains the website, does great work. He's a creative hotspot in Liverpool. Thank you very much for all of the nice things you said recently, your messages of support, and all of the things that you've done. I'm very, very grateful, and I couldn't do any of it without you. So, until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. I am in London. This has been The Unexplained, and please stay safe, stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Thanks very much. Take care. Bye-bye.